And so at the New Yorker, it was agreed, I mean, how much do you humiliate the Arab man? We've already done two or three stories about it. You know, let's just run this picture and let it go. So she's changed her mind about the war, and so she gives it to me. And then later she tells me this. We stay in touch. She says, what I didn't tell you is this. When my daughter came back from Iraq, very pretty girl, every weekend she began to go and get tattooed. Large black tattoos that filled up her whole body. She said it's as if she didn't want it to change her skin. And so I suggest to you that we are sitting on a time bomb of returning people, of guilt. You can't do what's been going on. God knows what's going on out there. It can't be good. And there's going to be a lot of people, no matter how much braggadocio or bravado come in, that's going to need a lot of help. We learned in Vietnam, in the early 80s, Vietnam vets, 10 years after the war, were coming in to the Veterans Administration outpatient psychiatric clinic at the rate of $7,500 a month, $90,000 a year for help. And so I think we're going to pay a huge price. We all know about the horrific casualties that we have, but there's also going to be the psychic scarring. And so there we are. The cheerful message is over. Somebody asked me for something upbeat. Let's do a lot of questions and see where we go. That's the end of my speech.
You're listening to investigative reporter and author Seymour Hersh speaking on March 24th in Ithaca, New York. This is Unwelcome Guests, and you're tuned to WEOS Geneva, WXXE Fenner Syracuse, 88.1 Ithaca Community Radio, KRFP Moscow, Free Radio Olympia, KQRP Salida, 101.1 Free Radio Santa Cruz, or Free Radio Asheville. We continue with Seymour Hersh as he took questions from the audience.
In 2001, I would have been laughed at if I had accurately predicted the condition of America in 2005. Give us your prediction that what America will be like in 2009. Why don't we just settle? Let's hope we have an election. How's that? Let's go down low. Yep. Let's just hope we can get through that far. Go, yes.
Okay. So I just read an article that the U.S. Navy is going to be suing the AP for releasing the Abu Ghraib story and publishing the photos. They're saying it's copyright infringement and defamation.
Yeah. Did you read that in The Onion?
No. I read that in the Ithaca Journal yesterday. I've got it cut out in a scrapbook at home, and I kind of wish I brought
it. That's actually as much of a laugh riot as you can get. I mean, you know, that's... I am sure there's some officer somewhere would like to do more than just sue because of that story. But
question is if you feel that the Navy is overstepping its bounds in this case, and if you could talk a little bit about if this is not an amendment of RSRA.
I would say the Navy ought to stick to keeping its steps, its feet on people's necks. Yes, which they seem to do all right, some of the SEALs. So stick to necks. I don't think that's going to happen. I just don't know. Another question. Compare and contrast the Nixon. These are good questions. Not that yours wasn't. The Nixon administration's reaction to the My Lai 4 scandal to the Bush administration reaction to Abu Ghraib scandal. What a difference. My Lai, they dealt with it. And they still tried to suppress it, but once it became public, there was enough officers. There was a tremendous concern inside the armed forces about it. I don't think there was nearly as much of a concern inside now because having draftees in the military really helps. It leavens it, and there are people more connected to the real world. When you've got an all-professional army that we have, sometimes it's easy to get isolated. I think we had a presidential candidate, Mr. Kerry, that chose not to talk about Abu Ghraib or raise it because he thought it wouldn't do him much good in the campaign, and of course that's why he won, because he chose not to go the right way on Iraq, didn't want to make an issue. But anyway... So it didn't become an issue, except, but I will tell you what happened. In every sense of the word, Abu Ghraib was as significant in the Middle East and Europe as My Lai, because particularly in the Middle East, Abu Ghraib, with the sexual abuse, made many people most Muslims, as you know, overwhelmingly most Muslims, not only have nothing to do with horrific, any crimes or any terrorism, also disliked in the Muslim Quran, terrorism isn't part of the game. And they view these people as heretics. And most of them have a great deal of a fondness for American individuals, not anymore collectively the government. But most of the Arabs really thought we were sexually perverse. This struck them as an evidence of a sexual perversion in this country. the kind of country that just wondered who we are and what we are, that we could do this. And there's the other thing to say about My Lai, Vietnam, and this war now. And that is, Vietnam, as awful as it was with the casualties, we always say quickly 58,000 Americans, and we only say 2 to 3 million Vietnamese, south and north, right? As if there's not really that much difference between 2 and 3 million. I always love that stuff. But that's what the name they put the numbers at. So this is a war that has, what, 1,530 or 40 Americans so far, many more injured, who knows how many Iraqis. But Vietnam was always a tactical mistake. We did this stupid, dumb war for the dumbest of reasons in the most brutal ways, and 5 years after the war is over, we're busy trying to make deals for travel trips and hotels, and the Vietnamese want us back in their society. They want to do business with us. This war is strategic. We are in a strategic crisis. We have made enemies for life. We have made enemies of people who believe in revenge that can be in 2 or 3 generations. In the Taliban society, 5 generations can work for revenge. I'm just telling you what scholars have written. We have made war on a society. And one of the things that in the book I did, the book begins with a meeting in Condoleezza Rice's office on Guantanamo in the fall of 2002, 6 or 7 months before we go to war in Iraq and long before Abu Ghraib. And what's the issue? The issue is a very competent CIA guy that knows Arabic has gone down to Guantanamo because there's no good intelligence out of it, despite all you heard about great stuff coming out of nothing. Got 600 Arabs there, and he comes back and he writes a blistering report. This is a guy whose Arabic is fluent, was born in that part of the world, and he says in this report to George Tenet, the CIA director, who got it to Condi, he says, at least half the people there have nothing to do with anything. And he said, it's unbelievable. I saw 70, 80-year-old men living in their own excrement, the mistreatment. And he said, but here's the horrible point. If they weren't Al-Qaeda when we got them, they are now. What are we going to do? It gets to Condoleezza Rice because of a couple really good guys, a general named John Gordon, a 4-star Air Force general, the most admirable guy in the world, works in the White House. He's going to be damned if they're not going to have a discussion about that. There are other guys who worked in the White House. All these people are long gone. He's going to be damned if they're not going to have. So they get to Condi Rice, and she agrees. They have a meeting. Rumsfeld comes in. He'll say, mumbles, I'll take a look at it. Nothing happens. Everybody's very disappointed. The two things struck in the people's crawls who pushed for that meeting. Well, three things. One of them, of course, is nothing happened. They were shocked and disillusioned that nobody cared, because you can't treat prisoners that way. Any military guy knows. You don't treat people that way because you don't want your people treated that way. And you also know when you got people that are going to fly airplanes in the buildings to kill the infidels, you're not going to get them to tell you what's going on by breaking their fingers. Torture doesn't work. You've got to do something else. Change their mind. But the other thing that stood out in their minds was when they had the internecine struggle inside the White House to get a meeting, to get this information to Condi, two offices fought it tooth and nail, Cheney's office, and the chief legal guy, Gonzalez, did not want the meeting. Anybody then, Guantanamo, Gonzalez's office said, deserves to be there and should rot in hell and stay there. That's what's the attitude. The same Gonzalez. We know what he's doing now. Let's do another question.
Okay. Given the speed with which the Patriot Act was rammed through Congress after 9/11, what do you think? I think that we're one terrorist incident, real or imagined, away from martial law. What's your opinion on that?
Oh, I think the Senate will protect us. Let's keep on going. I'm joking.
In the years that you've been out there reporting and doing this investigative reporting, how have you seen access to information change? Have you seen access to information change? And how have you, as an investigative reporter, continued to get the information and get the story out there that other people aren't?
Oh, well, that's, I can't get into that, but it's certainly changed for the worse. I mean, I'll just tell you an example of one way it changed that's very profound. As no journalist I know wants to write something, and I get into cutting-edge operational stuff. I did a story about stuff going on in Iran, and before you do it, you want to make sure you're not going to write a story that's going to actually jeopardize people. And the intent in talking to the government about it is not to be censored, but to tell them, I'm doing the story, get your people out of harm's way, because we're doing it. And in years of doing that, I've always had, even with people I have enormous antipathy for, like Kissinger, because, he was a guy that lies like all of us breathe, and here he is in public life. And so, but even with those people, it's always been able to go and have a conversation and say, here's what I'm doing. This is the only government, You can't get that kind of, you can't even get that kind of level of agreement with. I still go to people, I have to go take a galley proof from the New Yorker and drive out to the suburbs and stick it in somebody's box on the night before, you know, it gets closed. And he takes a risk by calling me and gives me a call and tells me what he thinks I should, what line to take out or something. I have to do it on the sly. This is a government that's really very cut off from the normal process. I mean, you all know that. You all sense it. Why do you think the stories, the newspapers are in such trouble? They can't. You either do it the way they want you to do it, or you can't get to the table. You know, you're either with them or against them. That goes across the board.
There has been a deafening silence subsequent to the publication of your article about the presumed plans for a bombing in Iran in June. There has been no talk in the press.
Well, there was talk in Europe quite a bit about it, I will tell you that. I mean, the Europeans were very, it was all over the world. And it was, you know, it's ironic. The German ambassador told me that the day of that story, which appeared on a Sunday night in the New York, it was the lead story in every paper in Germany the next morning, and here it gets blocked out. There is sort of a sense in this country that there's sort of forbidden knowledge. You know, there's just things, I don't know what's going to happen with Iran. I know it's on the table. As somebody said, one of my friends said, a wonderful phrase, it's teed up. I don't think they're thinking of regime change anymore. I think the firing of Wolfowitz was very interesting because he's a neocon. I think maybe they're going to go back from the neocons would say the only reason you do Iran is you got to change the regime. And the hardliners would say, let's just bomb them to set them back on their nuclear ambitions. And again, the reality of whether or not they actually are close to a bomb or whether or not, you know, there's one thing that's amazing about these guys. We've got problems with the Syrians, we've got problems with the Iranians, we've got problems with the North Koreans, and the one thing in common is we don't talk to them. We don't talk to them. We have no bilateral conversations with them whatsoever. There's no discussion, and there's no public comment about it. There's nobody say, you know, people talk to me in the Senate, some of the Senate Democrats say sort of quietly, we really have to engage, but that's off the record. I literally have those kind of conversations. It's really damaging for a Senate. Everybody's running for president on the Democratic side, and so it's hard. You know, we're going to end up getting what we deserve, which is Hillary. Oh, let's see. What's happening with the Nuremberg precedent trial that was initiated by an American attorney's named Rumfeld et al. As defendants? It was a marvelous two or three different legal groups have filed cases, most here in America, but also in Germany, naming Rumsfeld as, you know, a war criminal. And it's not going to go anywhere because no American judge is going to do much. He was very worried about it. I will tell you that. I know from people in the Pentagon, he was rattled to death by it. But nothing's going to happen. Anybody other questions? Who was the lady? One more questions. Let's do. The woman that you want to, I don't mean to disrupt you. If you want to disrupt me, come and get it. Well, everybody, particularly you mean about early in the Gulf War when Al Jazeera was killed. Yeah, the head of CNN. Do you know what his punishment was? He went off with Sharon Stone. I'm told he went off to Fiji with Sharon Stone after quitting CNN. Isn't that amazing? I think it's probably a good deal. I don't know. Look, I don't know what to tell you. I just don't know what to tell you about it. I'm not going to tell you that I think we deliberately targeted journalists because I don't know. I don't know that. And that's inflammatory. And my private view on it, I've actually looked into it. It's absolutely a dry hole in terms of getting to the next step. People with let's just put it this way, people with much more closeness to the situation than you, people in Washington involved in the government, have very similar experiences and very similar thoughts and even some specific information, but without a piece of empirical evidence, you're biting your tail. The fact is journalists are dying like fleas there. They get killed quite often. They're targeted by everybody. Yes, soldiers don't like journalists, particularly when they're doing wrong things. Absolutely. That's not unique to this war. That's in every war. And that's not only just our soldiers. You know, the beautiful thing, the wonderful, the systematic thing about militaries is they're, you know, I'll concede enormous problems in World War II with this analogy and the Germans, but basically all armies fight on wars very horribly and very brutally and very sadistically and always try to kill those who might get in the way of what they're doing. That's just a given. And we, unfortunately, in this country, some of you have read Paul Fussell, who wrote about this, the historian who wrote, or the social critic who wrote all about how sensitive we were in World War II. The censorship was so extreme we never saw American bodies. We weren't allowed to see so many things. So we've had we got through World War II thinking, I grew up on these movies where Robert Ryan and Van Johnson would fly around in P-51s chasing the Nips, we called it, and the Americans always flew with the canopy open. And they had silk scarves, no helmets, and going like this. And I was thinking about this today. I was talking about it today earlier. And the Nips always had their cockpit closed, and they wore these little funny leather helmets, you know, the sort of geeky things that tied up, and they squinted and had big glasses. And at a critical moment, Robert Ryan would save Van Johnson. He would kill some Nip. And when I was, as a kid, watching this after World War II, the movie that we'd see Robert Ryan at the last minute save his buddy, and bullets would slam into the cockpit, and then the plane would go, you know, just in some little studios, I think about it, the plane would just start going down. Something would be going down, and we could hear the noise of the ooh, and just before it hit the water, a trickle of blood would come out of the Nip's mouth, corner of his mouth, and we'd all cheer. And so then, here I am, 20-some-odd years later, I'm writing Mili, and I'm saying, whoa, guess what? They is us, like Walt Kelly once said. They is us. We don't do it any better than they do. That was a horrible thought. And so it taught me something. You know, war is really bad. The really bad thing about what's happened in Abu Ghraib and all of this is that the real lesson of soldiering, of the military, is this. We send our boys and girls off to war. We give them to officers in local parentis. Their job is not only to keep them from being killed, but to protect these kids from the dumbness of themselves, from the 20-year-old dumbness. And that was the failing in Abu Ghraib, and that's the failing all the way along. Yeah, well, let's do, these are all sort of cosmic stuff here, but let's keep on going. Yes, sir.
Mr. Hirsch, in my lifetime, I don't think I've ever seen a time when the press seemed to be so embarrassingly easy to manipulate and control, even to the terminology. So that I don't remember any of the networks or any of the mass media referring to anything other than, for example, coalition forces, and I would like to know what coalition that was, or the war on terror when we invaded Iraq. And of course, that was begged the point.
You're dead right. There's never been, in my 40 years of doing this, being in Washington for most of them and New York, I've never seen anything like this. The histories at this time is going to be very rough on the journalists. I think it's a combination of very, very hard-minded guys in the White House, very tough, much more willing to lie to the American people, knowingly and deliberately, mostly from the Pentagon. If the CIA, under the law, ran propaganda operations like the Pentagon would, they'd have to be approved by the president under the law, and he has to sign a finding and brief to the Senate and the House Armed Services and Intelligence Committees, particularly the Intelligence Committees. And the CIA was also barred from doing any propaganda in America. It could only do it abroad. The Pentagon has no such restrictions. The Pentagon's interpretation of if they do mischaracterize or lie or use propaganda, it's constitutionally in the president's right as commander-in-chief to prepare the battlefield, to help our boys in combat. He's got the constitutional right to do it without telling Congress. That's an interpretation they've made. It's stunning. The networks in particular are completely cavil. It's essentially, oh God, I keep on getting more and more. Initially, I used to respond to these questions by saying, ask me about the press, and I'd say, I'm not into self-immolation. But, you know, I have to live with these guys, and I have a lot of respect for them. And there are papers, and Knight Ritter's done some fantastic stuff, the Washington Post. My own newspaper has been better lately, but it's had some very bad times. The New York Times, that is. I think it's going to be, as you said, this is going to be an astonishingly bad mark on the First Amendment. It's an embarrassment. Okay.
You've been listening to Seymour Hersh, reporter with The New Yorker magazine and author of Chain of Command, speaking on March 24th at Ithaca College. Thanks to Chris Wheatley of WICB and the Park School at Ithaca College for making this recording available to us. In his talk, Hirsch said there were no Western reporters in Fallujah to witness what the American forces did there. But there was one, only one, documentary filmmaker Mark Manning. You may have heard the interview we broadcast in February with Mark Manning just after his return. He was reporting that, within 10 hours of arriving in San Francisco, his hotel room and car were both broken into. His camera bag with his tapes taken in Fallujah, documenting the atrocities there, were stolen. They were the only thing stolen. Not cash, not jewelry, not computers, only that. I'm going to read you a report he wrote on what he witnessed there. This report was published on March 30th in Information Clearinghouse. By Mark Manning, he wrote, "I got back from Iraq a few weeks ago, where I stayed inside the city of Fallujah and lived with the refugees of that city for over 2 weeks. I decided to go there because it seems to be the heart of the trouble in Iraq and the place to see if any sense of peace can be found. I had also heard that the city had 250,000 citizens in it who were told to leave when my government attacked, yet there had been no stories of their situation in our media. As an American, I felt responsible for this and decided to take a look myself. On February 10, 2005, I flew into Iraq and drove to the city of Fallujah. For over 2 weeks, I was a resident and a refugee of Fallujah, and I am honored and privileged for that experience. They hosted me in their homes and cared for me because they believed that I was there to listen to them and to honestly bring home their stories to the American people. I came to Fallujah without military escort or armed protection in any way. I think because of this, they thought I was crazy. But they honored what they thought was courage, and they trusted me." Trust means everything there, and they look deep into your eyes as they decide who you are. I lived with them and listened to their stories. They told me they do not trust American journalists to accurately tell the story of Iraq. They believe that the American public does not know what is really happening there, and that if they did, they would feel differently about the war. They feel that the American people are their brothers and sisters, and they are asking them for help. They wanted me to tell you their story. The horrors of war have been brought to the people of Fallujah. The people there say the city had 500,000 people in it, not the 250,000 quoted by our media. The refugees told me that they were given 1 week notice to leave the city. After 3 days, they were told they could no longer drive out. They had to walk. No camps were established for them, and no refugee location was given. There was no planning by the American government for the people, no food, no shelter, and no water. They were just told to leave or be killed. Anyone who stayed in the city after 1 week would be considered a terrorist and would be killed. For 5 months, these people have been living in any location they could find. Nothing was established for them in the surrounding areas of the Fallujah countryside. They are living in tents in the mud, schools, abandoned chicken coops, burned-out buildings, cars, and other buildings that people were not using or where others have made room for them. The weather is bad, with much rain, and it is very cold. When they were told to leave the city, it was summer, and they were not dressed for this cold, and many could not carry out their clothes. Some lucky children are going to school in tents, and all the classes have been shortened to 2 hours per day. Food is short, and they are eating what the farmers grow and the surrounding community can spare. Again, even after 5 months, they have received no outside aid from either the American government or the new Iraqi government. The city itself has been devastated. Most houses have been seriously damaged, with about 65% of them totally destroyed. Evidence of depleted uranium shells is everywhere. This leaves radioactive contamination behind, which has a half-life of 4.5 billion years. Unexploded ordnance is a common sight. Many residents who were there speak of chemical weapons, napalm, cluster bombs, and phosphorus used by the Americans. These are all illegal weapons and considered war crimes by the international community. Many of the houses were fired, meaning that the troops burned them down after searching them. Many houses with white flags and markings stating "Family Here" were destroyed. some families who had nowhere to go stayed in the city during the fighting and have paid dearly. I interviewed many people who were there, and their stories will live forever in my mind. Here are some samples. A mother whose son was killed by DU shells. He was in his bed sleeping when the shells came through the walls. A father who, at 65 years of age, was shot during a raid of his house, whose son was arrested during that raid and has not been seen since. He states that his son was not a fighter. A 17-year-old girl who hid under her bed with her 13-year-old brother during a raid of her house and witnessed her father, her cousin, and her two sisters, 18 and 19 years old, all shot to death. She hid for 3 more days with the dead bodies of her family, and then they returned and shot her and her brother after finding them under the bed. Her brother died. She survived and told me her story. A family of 10 who lived through all the fighting. The kids were 3, 4, 5, 7, 8, 10, and 12. They were a mess. These kids will never be okay. Their faces were marked with open and oozing sores, and they were exhibiting serious signs of emotional damage. There is presently very little medical aid available to the residents and refugees, and again, no aid has been provided to the refugees in the surrounding area. The medical centers in the city have been destroyed and have not been rebuilt. The main hospital has been reopened, but to get there you have to walk, as the ambulances are still being shot by the Americans and the Iraqi National Guard. The doctors have been beaten and their lives have been threatened by the Iraqi National Guard. These are the security forces that the Americans are training. The new government has warned them not to talk to any journalists about the conditions in Fallujah. They understand this threat to be very real and a direct threat on their lives and the lives of their family. To walk to the hospital, you must go through checkpoints, sometimes through fighting, and only at certain daylight hours. The checkpoints are manned by the Iraqi National Guards, and they are very hostile to the residents of Fallujah. When we were at the hospital, an old man died of a heart attack because he was not allowed through the checkpoint. A woman gave birth in the ambulance because they would not let the ambulance back to the hospital after 5 p.m. and instead turned it away with her in labor. We delivered by hand the medical aid provided by some of you to the hospital in Fallujah. Me and one Iraqi woman, we were the international medical aid to Fallujah. We carried these boxes one at a time through the checkpoints, across the bridge, and into the hospital. They would not let us drive in. We had to walk these boxes in. We did it every day for a week, one box at a time. All of the people I talked to had messages to the American people. They said, "We did not attack you. We have done nothing to the Americans. Why have you done this to us?" These are the people who hosted me, fed me, and worried about my safety. They took care of me, and I will never forget their generosity, compassion, and grace. They want peace with America, and they want the fighting to stop. They feel they are the ones being attacked, and that the Americans are the terrorists. They see absolutely no justification for this war, and were constantly asking me to explain how the American people can support these acts against a civilian population. For the first time in my life, I was ashamed to be an American. There are so many more stories to tell you, and I will be making a film about it all. But for now, what I want you to know is that I spent 2 weeks in the heart of the beast, the place where our government and media said is the heart of the resistance, terrorists, and Saddam loyalists. And guess what? The place is full of people. People like you and me. Kids are everywhere. The average Fallujah family has 10 people in it. That means about 8 kids. 500,000 people in the city. You do the math. That is a lot of kids. There are fighters in Fallujah. That's a fact. But they are surrounded by some 490,000 innocent people. As a country, we have decided the damage to the innocents is worth the end result, whatever that may be. These people are being shattered by this very serious situation that they have no control over. They are the innocent victims of this war. I cannot tell you what to do. This is a story of just one area in Iraq. These stories are all over the area we call the Sunni Triangle. But I was there, and I lived with these people, and they taught me about love, forgiveness, truth, and compassion. they, after all that has happened to them, still have the ability to differentiate between the acts of an enemy and the people of a nation. They cry out to us to save them from the ignorance that has brought this destruction on them. They have suffered 33 times 9/11. Over 100,000 Iraqis have died at the hands of the American invasion, and still they say they have nothing against the American people. This is grace. I learned from these people how to find peace. By deeply listening to my quote-unquote enemy, I have found that the real enemy is ignorance and fear and acting from that place of weakness. I will never forget the people of Fallujah. Thank you for listening to them. That an article by documentary filmmaker Mark Manning, published in the Information Clearinghouse on March 30th. Robert Jensen is a professor of journalism at the University of Texas in Austin. He spoke with Tom Jackson on March 17th about his book, Citizens of the Empire, The Struggle to Claim Our Humanity.
We're talking today with Robert Jensen, author of Citizens of the Empire, The Struggle to Claim Our Humanity. Robert, thanks for being with us today.
Great to be with you, Tom.
In reviewing the book, it seems as timely, if not even more so now. You wrote it in 2004, I believe, and talk a lot about not only post 9/11 politics in the United States, but also post February 15th, 2003, that being the day when so many people around the world got out in the streets and protested the impending invasion of Iraq. Could you maybe just first give a brief synopsis of what the book's about and why you felt compelled to write this book?
Yeah, I think it's important to think through this question of empire. Prior to 9/11, if you made the argument that the United States was an empire, you were usually labeled part of the loony left and laughed out of the room. But post 9/11, we've had an interesting shift in which even people on the right, even people in the centers of power, acknowledge that the United States is in fact an empire different in some senses than perhaps the British Empire or the Roman Empire, but an empire in the sense of having a worldwide reach through both military and economic power, and also empire in its most fundamental sense, which is the capacity to control the political sovereignty of other nations. And the United States has that capacity, and it exercises it frequently in order to concentrate its own wealth and power. That's an empire, and it's, I think, very important that we have finally, at least many of us in the U.S., have come to terms with the notion that the U.S. is an empire. The idea at the core of the book is that we are different in another sense, however, and that is we have not subjects. The British Empire, for instance, had subjects. The Roman Empire did not have a free and fully democratic system. But in the United States today, at least in legal terms, we are a democracy, and we are citizens of an empire. And I think the challenge, as I would put it in its most concentrated form, to the people of the United States today is, can we be something unique in history? Can we be the first citizens of an empire who, through internal political activity, end the empire? And I don't mean end the United States. I don't mean destroy the country. I mean shift the United States from an imperial stance to a stance of being not the nation on top of the world, but one of many nations in the world. And that's really what is the idea at the core of the book. How do we do that? How do we come to terms with the reality of our own history and our own place in the world today? And how do we move forward from that?
Well, it brings me to the subtitle of the book, the full title being Citizens of the Empire, The Struggle to Claim Our Humanity. And I agree with you that nowadays it seems widely acknowledged that the United States is an empire. But it's interesting to read the second part of the title, The Struggle to Claim Our Humanity. Can you talk a little bit about what you mean by that?
Yeah, that's perhaps more controversial, because the argument I'm making, and is implicit in that subtitle, is that when you live in the empire, you cannot fully claim your humanity. That is, if you're affluent, as it is in the United States, I think, if your affluence is based in part on the subjugation of people elsewhere. If we all know that in some way we are a rich and prosperous country because other people suffer historically and in the contemporary period, then we know that we don't really have access to our full humanity. We're not part of the world. We're disconnected from the world in that sense. And it's important that in the subtitle I call it the struggle to claim our humanity, not to reclaim our humanity, because I want to also emphasize not only the sort of imperial nature of the U.S. today, but acknowledge that historically we are in this position of wealth and power because of a series of quite barbaric acts that created the United States. So I think that if we want to truly claim that humanity, we both have to come to terms with our history and the contemporary period. And then, of course, that leaves us with a challenge. Can we organize politically to try and change the nature of this government and this system? And I think I say system meaning not just the public face of it in terms of our government, but also the economic system in which we live. I'm one of those people who still thinks it's important to critique capitalism, to talk about why, in fact, capitalism and democracy are fundamentally incompatible from my point of view, and why this system of capitalism is a threat not only to equality around the world and democracy, but also a threat, quite literally, to the continuing sustainability of the planet, the ecological question. All of these things, I think, are right in front of us. They are pressing and compelling questions, and in a country that offers a lot of ways to avoid those issues, a lot of what I like to refer to as the cheap toys of empire, television, cheap food, easy entertainment, lots of ways to disconnect from the world. I think our challenge is to reconnect with the world and face up to these issues.
Throughout the book, you do, in developing your argument, you do a considerable amount of looking at some terminology and defining those things and defining the differences between certain words such as hope as opposed to optimism, being critical as opposed to being cynical, nationalism as opposed to patriotism. Can you just talk about some of those words and the differences between them for a minute?
Sure. In the bigger picture, when one faces political crises, when one sees the world in trouble and wants to act, I think we often want to say it's time to act, not to sit around and theorize, not to think. But this is actually a moment in which I think it's very important to theorize, and I don't mean that in a kind of academic and elitist sense, but in trying to understand how the world works. And sometimes that means trying to understand how language works and trying to look at ways in which language is used to keep us trapped. So, for instance, there's a chapter on the question of the support the troops rhetoric. We all want to be nice people. We all want to support our fellow countrymen and women. And so we want to, we often have a reaction where we want to support the troops. But I try to talk about how the whole support the troops rhetoric is designed to keep people away from political engagement, and we can't sort of fall into that trap. As you point out, I try and distinguish between what might seem like similar concepts but can be quite different. For instance, I talk about the difference between hope and optimism, which is a distinction many people have written about over the years. I talk about the fact that I'm not optimistic in the short term, but I have hope in the long term. That is, I look at the world, I see the way in which right-wing forces have really become extremely powerful in this country, and I'm not optimistic that I'm going to wake up tomorrow and see, a progressive revolution in the U.S. It doesn't mean I don't have hope that that can't be achieved, but I think we have to distinguish between our rational assessments of what is possible in the short term, because if we don't do that, then we often develop very unrealistic expectations. And I think we have to distinguish between those things and a longer period question, a longer term question of how to have hope, how to understand that people are capable of very creative action, and that we look back at history and see that even when short-term attempts to bring progressive change failed, those people who kept at it over time, who had hope for the long term, were often very successful. And here I think it's incredibly important for people in the U.S. to think a lot about history, because this is a very short-term, immediate gratification kind of society. And that's true not only of the mainstream culture, but that does affect the left and the progressive movements as well. And there have been many points in history when immediate short-term change just wasn't possible, and people had to dig in for the long term. Certainly that's the story of the labor movement. It's the story of the civil rights movement. It's the story, in fact, of every movement that has tried to challenge concentrated power. And I think we have to, you know, pay attention to that so we don't develop unreasonable expectations and then be extremely depressed and passive and paralyzed when those short-term expectations aren't met.
So now, getting back to the timing of coming out with your book, Citizens of the Empire, to a post 9/11 and also post February 15th, 2003 world. Now here we are, post 2004 election, something that caused a fair amount of progressives and liberals a certain level of depression and frustration. Just recently, the Senate snuck through a provision that opens up the coastal plain of the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge to oil drilling. Every day we're hearing about deaths in Iraq and elsewhere. Where do people who want to somehow affect change find hope?
Well, here I might be a little unusual, because while I was not happy about the election of George Bush in 2004, I must say that I woke up that day without that sense of depression or angst that many people in the left progressive community had. And that's because I didn't have very high expectations. I thought the Democrats ran the worst possible campaign. I felt they had virtually no possibility of winning once the Kerry campaign made a strategic decision to abandon the anti-war movement and to really turn away from the one source of strength and energy that could have propelled the Democrats forward. Now, this was not surprising to me, in part because I have so few expectations from the Democratic Party in its current form. So I woke up, the day after the election, basically feeling the same way I did the day before, which is that there's a lot of work to build grassroots institutions in the United States that can carry forward left progressive political work. I happen to work in one in Austin, Texas, that we started about a year and a half, 2 years ago. And we have a goal. Our goal is to continue to work on issues in the short term, to organize people and educate people about the war in Iraq and about U.S. corporate globalization and those sorts of things. But also, our goal is to be around in 5 years and in 10 years. That is one of the things that typically we have not done very well on the left progressive side in recent decades, is build long-lasting institutions where people can know that down the road there will be the same folks there working on the same issue and sticking with it. And so I woke up the morning after the election and had the same work in front of me that I had the day before. And quite frankly, if John Kerry had been elected, I don't think that work would have changed. I think that the Democratic Party represents a different set of interests in the elite culture, but still represents interests from the elite culture. And my goal is to be part of the process by which we build a grassroots movement that represents ordinary people, not those elite interests.
In the latter part of your book, speaking of institutions, you talk about the educational system, particularly the college educational system, and of course the media. How can people who want to bring about change affect those and work with those institutions? It seems as though in both cases, to a great extent, there's been a sort of massive scale of takeover or a sort of buyout, privatization, if you want to call it that, of those institutions, and their particularly mainstream media just seems so conservative nowadays. How can individuals affect change there?
Well, I think those are two very important institutions to think about, education and the news media. Now, it just so happens that I've spent my entire adult life as either a journalist or a teacher. So these are the two main ways in which we socialize people in this culture, and they are therefore incredibly important. How do we affect change? Well, it's a different question for each institution. On higher education, for instance, there is, as you point out, a move toward privatizing, toward reducing public funding and forcing universities into the private sector. And of course, when you do that, those institutions will increasingly reflect the interests of the private sector. and we need to support public education, public support for higher education. Of course, there's also a very real threat today to academic freedom, to the right of university professors to pursue critical inquiry. We see that, for instance, most clearly in the attack on Ward Churchill at the University of Colorado. And so tenure and academic freedom, which may seem like rather arcane issues to people outside the university, are in fact very important to the intellectual and political health of the country, I think. So there are places where people can you know, move on those two issues. In the media, I think it's a very complex but very important strategic question. How do you try to create a more democratic media system? Well, the first thing, as you point out, we have to observe is that the U.S. media system, kind of unique in the industrial world, is almost completely commercial. There's no meaningful public broadcasting system in the U.S., for instance. So one question is, how do we try to create political support for public broadcasting that would be truly independent, both of corporate interests and of government interests? There are ways in which I think we can try to support those within journalism who really do have the ideals that, that have always motivated the best journalists. That is, the ideals of, you know, to use the old phrase, comforting the afflicted and afflicting the comfortable. Well, there are journalists working in the system who would very much like to be able to pursue those kinds of goals, and a public movement can support them. I think things like strengthening the union for journalists, a very weak unionized industry, for instance, would be helpful. And then, of course, there's alternative media. And it's important to recognize that alternative media are important not only for the unfiltered news that you can get, that is, news not filtered by the corporate media, at least. They're important to us in the way they deliver information to us. But they're also important in the way that they push the mainstream media. There are many examples when stories that break in the alternative news media can affect how the corporate commercial news media work. And so there are all of those things, you know, trying to create a better structure for public broadcasting, trying to support journalists in their willingness to do good work, and of course supporting and using alternative media. All of this is part of a media strategy, I think, that can be quite exciting. And there's work going forward on that. I know and many people are probably familiar with a group called the Free Press, which is organizing around questions of regulation of broadcasting, for instance, trying to put the public into that issue more directly. There's a conference in St. Louis in mid-May that will take up some of those issues. So there's a lot of places where people can today go lend their efforts.
Can you give us an example of a story that broke in alternative media that went on to affect mainstream media somehow?
Sure. The successes here are sometimes few and far between. I don't want to over-dramatize it. But take a story people might be familiar with. In the 1980s, in 83, 84, folks may remember that Donald Rumsfeld was appointed a special envoy by the Reagan administration to go to Iraq and try and smooth things over with the government of Saddam Hussein. So this monster that we are told about so often, who in fact was truly monstrous, was in fact a U.S. ally through much of the 1980s. And there was actual footage, video of Donald Rumsfeld meeting with Saddam Hussein. Some may be familiar with the famous still photograph taken from that of Rumsfeld shaking hands with Saddam Hussein. Well, that story was broken. The fact that that meeting happened and the consequences and conditions under which that meeting went forward, that was broken by an independent journalist, a man who was a producer for Democracy Now! And also an independent journalist. And it made its way onto the web. And eventually the mainstream media, the New York Times, the Washington Post, those kinds of places, did have to run stories acknowledging this. Now, it was important not just because it kind of pointed out that Donald Rumsfeld was a hypocrite, which is hardly news in that sense, but it pointed out the bigger story, which is that the United States had been supporting Saddam Hussein through some of the worst of his atrocities in the 1980s, and that U.S. interests were not around democracy and freedom. U.S. interests in the region were around control and domination. So that's one example of how that kind of work by independent journalists can affect the mainstream. And I think to the degree we help fund, and it's very important to stress, independent media needs financial support. They can't do what they do, you know, on a wing and a prayer. that the degree to which we fund and support that kind of journalism, it will have increasingly effects, I think, on the mainstream.
You talked a few moments ago about the difference between hope and optimism. Another difference that you point out, or a couple of terms that you talk about in Citizens of the Empire, it's the difference between being critical and being cynical.
Right.
And, of course, many, many people, I've experienced it, and I know a lot of people who are listening who, you know, take a progressive stance on politics and who are progressives at heart, get into discussions with people and are accused of being cynical when they're just being critical. But could you kind of describe the, the difference and why that's important to distinguish that?
Yes, I think it's a crucial difference. I spent much of my life being cynical. And I was a journalist, and journalists tend to be cynics in general. And I thought, that being cynical made me smarter than everybody else. And it was only sort of later in life, after I started to become more politically active, that I realized that cynicism is actually a very self-indulgent and, frankly, quite juvenile reaction to the world. Yes, the world has problems. Yes, people seem to routinely behave in ways that are often impossible to fathom. Yes, there is suffering that sometimes, is beyond description. All of that's true. It's also true that the world is full of solidarity and compassion and people who rise above their own self-interest to do quite extraordinary things. And a cynic looks at only the negative and then, I think, in sort of self-congratulatory ways, comes to the conclusion that nothing is possible and then retreats. I think someone who is critical but engaged looks at the world in all its complexity, looks at the good and the bad, and asks, how do we move forward to try and make the world a better place? Now, for a lot of people, to express that, I think they're afraid of being called naive or idealistic. Maybe it's an odd world we live in which the word idealistic is now an insult. I hear students actually say that. Someone will express a very clear and passionate argument for justice, let's say, and other students will say, well, you're just being idealistic. Well, sure, and isn't that a good thing? I mean, shouldn't we encourage that? Shouldn't we, help people articulate the best ideals of being human? So, it's understandable why people want to retreat, because the world is, in very many ways, an ugly place. But the world is also, in very many ways, a beautiful place. And cynicism, I think, keeps us from recognizing the world in all its beauty and complexity, but also keeps us from acting. And that's really why people in power don't mind a cynical world. I think the folks who run this country would be very happy to see everybody sort of collapse into cynicism, because cynical people don't take political action. And critical people, people who are engaged, can take political action. So I think that distinction is incredibly important.
And one other distinction in terminology that you make that I think is absolutely crucial as a citizen of the United States in 2005 is the difference between nationalism and patriotism. Can you talk about that a bit?
Well, yes. And here I have a view that's somewhat different than many. I think we often talk about nationalism as a negative force, that kind of jingoistic, my country right or wrong conception of nationalism. And I agree, that's extremely dangerous and extremely, I think, juvenile again. It's a very limited way to see the world. What people often say then, but patriotism, love of country, a real love of country that includes the willingness to be critical and dissident is somehow acceptable. And in that chapter, I try to point out that, from my point of view, patriotism and nationalism are essentially always the same thing. I'm not only against that kind of jingoistic nationalism, that very chauvinistic nationalism. I'm, quite frankly, at this point, arguing against any conception of patriotism for a very simple reason, is that our allegiances, I argue in that chapter, shouldn't be to a nation. A nation is an arbitrary political unit. I think our allegiances in the world should be toward principles and ideals that we can universalize, that is, let's say, the concept of real freedom or real democracy, which I think we should want to make universal. I think we should have a commitment to those ideals, and we should have a commitment to a collective humanity. That is, I think we have to get past the point where we think there's anything special about being in this country, or that there's any special connection we have to people in this country. I try to think of my obligations and connections to the world, not to a nation. So in a sense, what I'm arguing is that I think patriotism is a kind of an artifact of history that we're going to have to get beyond. We've seen the destructive capacity of nation states. And I realize it's quite an undertaking to say, let's start thinking beyond the nation state, since our whole world, of course, is organized around the idea of states. We are citizens of a country. And I think that's one of the things that over the long term we're going to have to challenge, much in the same way I would argue we're going to have to think about how to challenge over the long term capitalism. Because from my point of view, the world cannot survive nation states and capitalism for much longer. These are, I think, inherently systems that concentrate wealth and power, and I don't think we can continue on that path indefinitely. So while we're working on short-term issues, let's try to stop the war. In fact, let's try to build a country in which war is not a policy option. All of those things are important, but it's also important to think creatively about the long term, about what kind of political organizations, what kind of economic organizations are really sustainable over the long term. I think those questions are important. I realize they can seem abstract, and in some sense it's easy to want to push those aside toward the more important and pressing issues. But I do think we have to always keep talking about them. I think one of the important political questions we have to face in this country is often not seen as political, and that's the level at which we live in the U.S. That is the incredible affluence of this country. I think it's fair to say, the most affluent country in the history of the world. And even those of us who live perhaps, you know, not at the elite level, we're not all Donald Trump, but most people in the United States live at a level of comfort that is really unknown in much of the world. Half the world's population lives on less than $2 a day. It's a striking figure that I think always need to keep in the forefront of our imaginations as we try to work politically. I think this leads to a conclusion that is often very difficult for people, which is, if we are going to really create a just and sustainable world, that is, if we are going to transform this world, it means, from my point of view, that the living standards of people in the United States are going to have to change, and that means change downward. That is, we are going to have to start consuming less. We cannot live at this level of affluence indefinitely if we want to bring both justice and sustainability to the world. Now, I don't think that means that it's our obligation to wake up today and sell everything we own and become impoverished, because that's not going to do anything to bring justice to the world. But we do have to start thinking about how are we going to step back from a high-energy, high-consumption lifestyle, because this lifestyle is not only not generalizable to the rest of the world, that is to say, if the rest of the world lived like we do, there would be simply no way the planet could continue. It's also not sustainable even if it's contained to the first world. That is, if the first world continues on this path, it's, from my point of view, highly unlikely that we're going to make it into the next century. Those are serious questions. I don't think there are simple answers to them, and I certainly don't think I'm in a position to dictate to people how they should live. But I do think this fundamental question of how can we scale back the way in which we live to a more just, that is, a level that we can try to bring to the rest of the world, and a more sustainable, that is, one that can truly be sustained over the long term, is at the heart of any progressive politics in the world today.
Okay, Robert Jensen, thank you very much for talking with us today.
And the interviewer, Tom Jackson of Joe Public Media in Portsmouth, New Hampshire. Our website is unwelcomeguests.org, and all shows are archived there in MP3. Our theme music, Unwelcome Guest, is performed by Billy Bragg and Wilco, with lyrics by Woody Guthrie. Thank you for listening.